I'm going to talk to you today about some work I've been doing over the past couple of years involving quantum black holes, and in particular, sub-Planckian black holes. So the idea that, black holes can possibly exist at the sub-Planckian scales. It's based on, basically what I'm going to talk to you about today is based on the following three papers that have come out over the past couple of years. To basically dive into the subject, we all know this is a very simplified diagram, but it represents the most basic problem in theoretical physics, is that the large and short scales that describe nature are described by two very, very different kinds of physical law, and length scales, in fact. Okay, so all this is a very simple plot of the two scales which govern physics. At the large scale, we know general relativity is the theory of choice. And with general relativity, we can associate a length scale being the horizon scale for a particular mass. And of course, if we simplify that down, it basically says that this length scale is determined by the mass, the size of the mass of the object. And of course, the other curve here, which we all know from basic quantum mechanics, is the Compton wavelength, which shows us that at the short scale, quantum mechanics is described by quite a different dependence on the mass. Right? So we have an inverse dependence for quantum mechanics and a linear for large scale. Somewhere in the middle, they cross. It's just a very simple thing. We can see it right there where the two curves cross. So we tend to think this point is a very critical, very important point in nature. And in fact, if you were to kind of redraw that diagram, you have what we could define as black holes existing along this line. We could define particles as existing along this line. And right at that discontinuous point where they meet, something happens, some phase transition, who knows what it is. It happens to occur, if you just follow basic natural units, it occurs at the Planck length, and it occurs at the Planck mass. So this allows us to put in perspective the two different, approaching this point from the two different curves. If you approach it from the left or from the right, you have two different interpretations. So we could think that if we are in a black hole and the black hole is evaporating down and getting smaller and smaller and smaller, it's going to reach some point where it will be the smallest black hole it can possibly be. And beyond that point, either this area, depending on which theory you want to believe, this could possibly be inaccessible or not. But the black hole might stop here, at which point quantum indeterminacy will take over. If you're a particle and you're living on the red line, then you come up here and you hit that point and you become the largest possible particle you can be. So the question is, this critical point, what is it? What does it define? And does it really delineate the difference between these two things? I mean, it would be much more palatable if we could have some kind of continuity here where we describe particles and black holes interchangeably by some common theory. So in a sense, this is the goal of quantum gravity, if you will. So we need a modification of the laws we currently have. And one of the most interesting routes to take is to modify quantum relationships so that they match with some classical relationships. And in doing so, we can introduce what's called the generalized uncertainty principle. So the generalized uncertainty principle is a modification of the traditional Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which basically does not contain this delta P squared term. And by introducing that delta P squared term, we modify the Hilbert space, the phase space, and all the relationships that follow through. The generalized uncertainty principle is a construct or a result of several disparate theories. It comes out of string theory. It comes out of some loop theories as well. And that appearance in different aspects lets us think that perhaps there's something more to this than just a coincidence or a happy modification. So to introduce gravitation into quantum mechanics, we can just propose that the GUP itself is a gravitational modification of quantum theory. And we can see that if we rearrange, just do a little algebra on this, we can define a quantum uncertainty that goes along with just the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And then we can define a gravitational uncertainty that basically depends on the gravitational radius or the gravitational spread of some kind of quantum system. Yeah, it goes basically as the horizon radius. So if I add these guys up as my total uncertainty, then because of the momentum dependence, and again, we see this duality, if you will, in momentum dependence between the two, just as we saw in the difference between the gravitational scale and the quantum scale, then my total uncertainty becomes something like this, which we recognize as the generalized uncertainty principle. Okay, I can get the same thing from that. And I see that duality coming out. I see that delta P and 1 over delta P in the momentum, and therefore by proxy in the mass, appearing there. So the generalized uncertainty principle can be thought of as an encoding of gravitation with quantum theory. So let's talk about black holes and the GUP. What happens when we introduce a generalized uncertainty principle into black hole physics? There are a number of papers in the literature that address this. I'll go over a couple of them. But of course, quantum gravity effects become important when we start broaching on the quantum scale, and especially when the GUP becomes relevant. Okay. So, an earlier paper by Adler and Chen did a first run approach at addressing the GUP and its impact on black holes. And they found, I'm not going to go over the paper in detail, as here's the reference, but they found in detail that if you introduce the GUP into black hole physics, you do find that you end up with remnants, black hole remnants. So there is some point where you follow the black curve cold, the black hole curve down, and it will stop, but the remnant is unstable. Okay, the temperature that they found for this remnant was very hot. It was a very hot remnant, and it was actually, their formalism was sort of a piecemeal one that didn't really depend on any formalism behind it. So, Bernard Carr, who's one of my collaborators on one of the papers, approaches his version of the GUP by introducing not just a generalized uncertainty principle for black holes, but also a similar uncertainty principle for quantum scales, for Compton wavelengths, something he calls the generalized event horizon and the generalized Compton wavelength. The black holes he gets out of this are thermally stable, thermodynamically stable, and in fact fed into what I'm going to talk about today. But he looked at the problem not just modifying this relationship from one perspective on one of those curves, but by modifying it on the other curve as well. And I'll go over the formalism in a bit. An earlier paper I did actually looked at a modification of general relativity, a GUP-based modification of this form, which is essentially you can show as a solution to the Einstein equations. You get a metric that depends on some GUP. This is that a GUP parameter beta. I'm not going to go into the specifics of this paper here, but what we were able to show is that you did end up with a minimum-sized black hole, okay, consistent with the earlier diagram. So you have a remnant, you have a stable remnant, and because you have a metric, you can do all kinds of thermodynamics on this. All right, just it's a standard GR exercise to do that. So you have thermodynamically stable remnants, which when we talk about quantum black holes is sometimes a desirable thing because we don't know what these things are. If they exist, they could be dark matter, they could be something else in the universe, who knows?
But this line remnant is something you introduce terminologically, or should I think of it as resulting from the solution of Einstein's equation?
It results from the solution. So we modify the stress energy tensor. Okay, and then solve, and the deformation of the stress energy tensor basically yields this result. Okay, so you get these gamma functions that come out of it, and this is a standard sort of modification that comes out in non-commutative geometries and the like as well. So we wanted to go a bit further though with the connection between the GUP and black hole physics. And so we thought, okay, this previous metric showed us that we could have a minimum scale black hole. But it didn't solve that problem of, well, what happens? Why can't we make that curve continuous? Okay, why can't it, if it comes down on the black hole side, why can't it continuously curve over to the particle side? In which case, you can have black holes that could exist at the sub-Planckian scale. So we wanted to address that issue. So can this thing happen? So what we did is we sat back and we looked at the GUP again. And we looked at that duality in particular that exists, if you look in the momentum, which of course implies the duality in the mass. And so what we thought was, all right, this, loosely speaking, tells us that delta x goes as 1 over delta p plus delta p, which of course means that delta x, some uncertainty in the position, will go as some quantum scale, basically, will go as 1 over the mass plus the mass of a black hole, if we want to associate delta p with m. And this was interesting because we thought, okay, this does bring out the GUP. Yeah, this is the GUP in black hole parlance. And we thought, is there another way we can encode this duality into the metric so that we can describe black holes at any possible mass scale? And our approach was as follows. So we actually did this. That's why we have a paper. And first of all, it requires some thought. So when you write this down in the uncertainty principle, these masses are not actually very well defined. Okay? They're actually defined very differently. Okay? Generally speaking, when we speak of a quantum scale mass, we're actually talking about something that we can measure empirically, say through root s or something. All right? And that is a measure of what the mass of a particle is. This guy, however, being a classical quantity, we tend to think of as being a well-defined quantity, such as the ADM mass. But to add these two things together becomes a bit of a murky interpretation, because I'm not sure what to make of either of these two masses. They're not the same things at all. They're derived from very different conditions. All right. So if you dig through formal definitions of mass, you come up with Komar integrals and the like that define your mass for a black hole. And we can define that again as basically some integral over the stress energy tensor, which is a standard procedure. And instead of integrating over all space, we're going to look at integrals specifically out to the Compton wavelength. And so can we define a similar sort of classical version of mass at the quantum scale? And so proceeding from that idea, we propose, we're guessing, that we can indeed do that. So whereas the metric we had before was derived from the Einstein equations, we're going to sort of do a little sleight of hand here, and we're going to say that, okay, we can do that. We're going to define the mass as the usual integral, okay, integral expression, except the form of T00 is unknown to us. It is some mix, some classical quantum mix, some quantum scale, in fact, some quantum gravity variety stress tensor.
Is there some definition of that, or is this just some placeholder?
It's just a placeholder, right? So is there a definition? Not yet. Okay, so we're looking, but we felt the motivation is strong enough to say, okay, well, let's suppose this thing does exist, okay? And what this thing does is it has such a form that it will give us this form of a mass that encodes the duality. Okay? And again, we have no idea what this looks like, but we're going to propose that it is there. Because it does, this is sort of metric engineering, I suppose you could call it, but there's a means to an end. Okay. So why do we want to do this? So beta is some parameter, it's a similar GUP type parameter that tells us how the momentum scales in the GUP. And we're going to scale it according to the Planck mass. All right. So assuming this works as it's supposed to, we can go through and do regular general relativity with it. And we can get a metric solution that looks like this form, where our function f of r is now this. Okay? And it looks like the Schwarzschild metric, because it basically is the Schwarzschild metric, with a modification here. And in fact, everything that you can do with the Schwarzschild metric, everywhere the Schwarzschild metric comes, be it an action principle or whatever, this thing could come from an identical thing, because the modifications are not length scale dependent. They're not position dependent, space time dependent. They are dependent only on this mass modification, this correction that we're throwing in. And in fact, everything kind of follows right from this. So
I'm confused, and maybe this will be clear later, but
sure.
Somebody might have said, look, I define whatever the mass to be via, if I define it via what the metric's doing, that just looks like some new definition of M.
Right.
So why don't I just call that M, and what are we actually doing?
Okay, well, I'll show you after this. Okay, so there's a method to the madness. So,
okay.
Yes. So why do we do that? Exactly. What is the point of doing this? Why? Well, because it allows us to address issues that involve all scales of mass. Okay, and in fact, if you look at this now, the Planck scale becomes a critical value. It's still a critical value for which the metric, if you're in the super Planckian regime, the metric is normal. It's Schwarzschild. It's as you would expect it to be. If you're in the sub-Planckian regime, it goes as this 1 minus 1 over, this is weird function, this is something different. Okay. So there is a distinction between what we can call them phases of gravity here, if you will. But what does this tell us? What does it mean? Okay. So, yes?
How is it you get that for m much larger than Planck?
Uh-huh.
If it's 1 minus m over, so if I look at, say, the gravitational mass measured at infinity,
mm-hmm.
I'll see the n Planck square in the denominator.
Well, it's g, right?
Oh.
Yeah, so I'm discounting the one out here. I'm just looking at this correction term, right? And all right, so what does this tell me? All right, what does this black hole look like? Let's do a thermodynamic analysis of it. So the first thing, what are the horizon characteristics? Well, the horizon is easy to solve, right? This is even undergrad level GR if you want. So I can solve for the horizon, and I can look at the horizon characteristics in three regimes. I'll look at them in the super Planckian regime, and in the super Planckian regime, they are as I expect. They go as the regular horizon radius. I can look at them at the Planckian transition, where I have the horizon behaving slightly differently. Now it goes as 1 over m instead of 1 over, or sorry, it goes as 1 over m Planck, so it's a constant, it's actually independent of m. And then I can look at it at the sub-Planckian level. And at the sub-Planckian level, the horizon expression approximates down, I get rid of my Planck scale. That's suddenly not an important point anymore. It's obviously present in these two, not here though, and it goes as 1 over m. And this is interesting because, so we can plot them out, they look like this. This is of course interesting because 1 over m looks like a quantum length scale. It starts to look like a Compton wavelength, for example. And if I plot these guys out, here they are for positive beta, these three curves on the top, and it actually reminds me, it's very reminiscent of, because it is a plot of the length scales in the GUP. Here's a Compton, a kind of a particle scale. Here's a black hole, relativity scale. And they are smoothly connected by some minimum point. And in a sense, this curve, there is no distinction of what's sitting on this curve. Okay? Anything that's a black hole here, if a black hole is coming down and evaporates, it's going to hit some minimum point. It's going to keep evaporating. And its horizon is going to do something strange. It's actually going to start growing. Okay. Negative beta is on here for a reason. There are a lot of problems with beta being negative, so we tend to ignore that. It allows for temperatures to diverge. When I get to temperatures, I'll talk about that. But this is an interesting start. Okay, just in guessing that we might have, what if we had a metric of this form? We have that. We have this behavior. So we already have captured an essence of the GUP. Okay, so let's keep going. If you have a metric, you can get a temperature. So we define it as the surface gravity as usual. And if I derive an expression for the temperature, it's a very easy thing to calculate, I get something that looks like this. Okay. And here is a plot of the temperatures. In the super Planckian regime, it basically goes as 1 over m plus there's a higher order correction term here. And of course, we recognize, you know, the uptick of the curve is very simply the temperatures we expect in classical general relativity. Except we reach a point where the temperature will max out. Okay? And in fact, it becomes a thermodynamically stable system. If you look at the corresponding variables. At this Planckian scale, the temperature becomes a constant. It basically becomes a Planck scale black hole. In the sub-Planckian regime, we have a downturn, we have a drop-off in the temperature, so it actually cools down. We have a cooling phase of this black hole, and that goes like this. Okay. And again, I've included higher order corrections here, but what I actually find more palatable is to get rid of those higher order corrections and just look at the leading term. Okay. And I see here's my usual temperature, okay, my usual Hawking temperature, 1 over m, constant, and then a temperature going as m. So I got a weird behavior of black holes in the Planckian regime again. Okay. But because their temperature goes as m, it means that as they evaporate down to nothing, their temperature disappears, which is a thermodynamically well-behaved system. And then lastly, what I can do is I can calculate the entropy. Okay? So standard expression for the entropy, I get this term here, this expression. And again, I can analyze this in the two extremal limits of sub-Planckian and super-Planckian. Super-Planckian, it goes as m squared, usual area, basically area entropy law. And the sub-Planckian behaves as the log of m. So there's my graph of entropy. I actually do get some kind of critical point here where the entropy drops to zero for some non-zero mass. Okay. So we have, again, some kind of remnant type structure. It's a bit strange, okay? It's a zero entropy remnant. But if we stop and think about the three things that I've showed you, they're familiar to me, certainly, because I'm working on this, but there's a reason these quantities are familiar, if you're familiar with thermodynamics of black holes. All right, so we've all seen the d-dimensional version of the Schwarzschild metric. Okay, we have, so this guy here has its horizon radius there, which is defined by some length scale here. Okay. And if I have this metric, I can do all kinds of thermodynamics on it, and I get the usual things that have appeared in the literature. Generally speaking, this is defined for d greater than 2 because, of course, d can't be equal to 2 here. But it can be equal to 1. Okay? And if I take the limit where d is 1, I can define a horizon radius that goes as 1 over m. Okay? And in fact, d equals 1. So this is a d plus 1 dimensional space-time. So this is now a 1 plus 1 dimensional space-time that we're looking at. And this has been looked at for a long time. In fact, Rob Mann looked at this way back in the 90s, and there was a whole push to look at dimensionally reduced general relativity at the time. Okay? And in this paper, they derived an exact solution to Einstein's equations in 1 plus 1 dimensions. It's called the R equals T solution. And with that solution is associated a metric. You have a metric. You can do thermodynamics. So what does the thermodynamics of a 1 plus 1 dimensional black hole look like? Well, you've seen it before because it was on the last couple slides that I looked at. Okay? Here are the metric functions for, in this case, standard Schwarzschild, and a 1 plus 1 dimensional version. Okay? There's a different dependence in coordinate position. But of course, in 3 plus 1 dimensions, we get our usual horizon goes as m, temperature goes as 1 over m, entropy goes as m squared. Doing the thermodynamics of a 1 plus 1 dimensional black hole, you get horizon going as 1 over m, temperature going as m, entropy going as the log of m. And of course, I've technically divided by m naught, some lower scale. So these are the values that we get out of our sub-Planckian metric. Okay? That it seems to suggest that as black holes transition into this sub-Planckian regime, they begin to act as if they were lower dimensional black holes. Okay? They're still living in 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time, if that's the dimension you choose, or d plus 1, whatever, but they act as if they are 1 plus 1 dimensional. There's an effective dimensional reduction going on in their thermodynamic behavior. Okay? So this seems to suggest, if you believe the argument from the beginning, that the sub-Planckian regime, insofar as gravity is concerned, is governed by what seems to be a lower dimensional effective theory. And so that's interesting because dimensional reduction, the idea of dimensional reduction at high energy scales is not new at all. And in fact, it is a feature of many, many different approaches to quantum gravity. One of the earliest ones was the causal dynamical triangulation program that showed that as you go to higher energies, the random walk of a particle becomes defined as if it were existing in a lower dimensional space, in fact, a two-dimensional space-time. Okay, this has appeared in many other places, in string theory, in string-inspired theories, brain worlds, evolving dimensions, or vanishing dimensions as they've been called, depending on which way you look at it. Multifractal gravity, Calcagni has a program where he looks at the dimensionality of space-time as being a continuous thing. So all of these, though, have the feature that as you go up in energy and down in length scale, you approach a lower dimensional effect of space-time. And in fact, sometimes in this case, it is not effective. It becomes lower dimensional space-time. So that's an interesting feature of this idea. This idea that we can tie in the generalized uncertainty principle to a dimensional reduction regime. So it looks like maybe the GUP itself implies dimensional reduction, which solidifies it a bit more as a feature of that we would expect from quantum gravity, because quantum gravity also implies dimensional reduction. I just want to say a little thing about this. So it is possible. So the idea, the original curve for the GUP had particles on one side, on the left side. They had black holes coming down the right side, and the two did not meet. But there's, because of the continuity of this curve, you can slide them back and forth, so one could be another, could be another. And the question is, well, can a black hole, what defines the size of the black hole in this theory? Are particles black holes, or are they not? In particular, because the horizon radius changes as 1 over m in the sub-Planckian regime, it means that very small mass black holes will have very large horizons. So we want to take care to differentiate whether we can call a particle a black hole or not, because, for example, we don't want neutrinos to suddenly be acting like black holes with these giant horizons, and then, well, they would hit one thing and then they would shrink back down. But we can avoid that if we do the following. So going back to Carr's idea that we can define not just a generalized event horizon, which looks like the GUP that we've been dealing with in the metric, we can also define a generalized Compton wavelength, okay, that includes this m plus 1 over m duality as well. Okay? So if it's good for one, it's good for the other. There's no reason it has to favor just one of the working theories. And this, you know, again, the algebra is obviously very simple. You can show that these coincide at some mass scale that is dependent on the parameters, the input parameters, the scaling parameters of each of those things. And if you do that, well, you can then plot these guys. And in this case, for different values of alpha and beta, I see that, well, for this case, where beta is 0.7, alpha is 0.5, my Compton curve kind of settles down here. Here's that minimum mass scale, whereas the gravitational scale, the radius, is up there. So in this case, the Compton wavelength of particles is much less than their gravitational radius, which is something we don't want, because then particles can become black holes and not necessarily a palatable conclusion. But of course, if you kind of fiddle around with these parameters and pump alpha greater than beta, basically, you do get a consistency there. And again, the value of alpha is not necessarily set by any physics. It was this new idea that we had to throw in a correction to the Compton wavelength. So, but by requiring that particles remain particles, so that their minimum quantum scale is greater than the equivalent gravitational scale for a black hole of the same mass, allows us to kind of fit the data, quote unquote, to fit the idea nicely. So that was that. All right. So a proper choice of parameters will tell us that we can keep particles and black holes separate if we so choose. Okay. So for the remainder of the talk, I want to shift gears a little bit, talk about some other work that I've done. And this is an idea of production of Planckian / sub-Planckian black holes, so quantum. How are these things made? Well, they could be made from evaporation processes for black holes in the primordial black holes or what be it. But of course, another avenue for production of black holes is possibly through high energy collisions. So where particles become black holes. So if I, of course, can scrunch in enough energy into a sufficiently small space through the Hoop conjecture, I can get a black hole out of a quantum collision. And we know that there's a bit of dimensional dependence on this. It's easier to do in higher dimensions than lower dimensions. And by this case, higher is more than 3 plus 1. But we can come up with sort of a very simple model that allows us to address the quantum nature of these kind of objects in what's called the horizon wave function formalism. And the basics of the horizon wave function formalism are as follows. So suppose we have an amount of mass m that is or energy that is collapsed into a particular region through collision. So does this form a black hole? Okay. Well, there's a couple questions to ask there. We want to ensure that, because it's a quantum mechanical approach, we want to assume, first of all, that the probability that the distribution is scrunched into some spherical region that is bounded by some value we'll call RH. Okay. We're going to make sure that happens. There's 2 and 3 on there together. But 2, the second one, is that if they get crunched into this region, we want to make sure that there's a strong probability that the particle, that RH is the horizon size of the particle. Okay. And then three is not really a separate step, it's sort of a combination of one and two, is that, well, the probability then must be high that the particle lies within RH, which is its gravitational radius. And so this prescription allows us to start talking about a probabilistic model that tells us what kind of quantum objects we can expect with what probability. So a bit more of a technical approach. Again, it's a very simple approach. I don't pretend that it's overly complicated. So if we have basically some eigenstate, energy eigenstate, where the energy is defined by this, which is essentially derivable from the Hoop conjecture, assuming that that your impact parameter is less than RH, you define a wave function in again, this is elementary quantum mechanics here. The coefficients that define the distribution of the energy eigenstates into position eigenstates will, or sorry, we'll call this the spatial wave function or state. These coefficients, essentially evaluated at this energy, are what we'll call the horizon wave function. We'll define then a spatial distribution for these guys, because remember we wanted this particle to be confined to some region of space, and let's assume it's some kind of Gaussian that has some width that is greater than the particle's Compton wavelength, or at least equal to. And by combining these guys together, this will give us the probability that if this mass is scrunched into this region, and if that region is indeed defined or limited by the horizon size of the particle, then we'll have a black hole as a result.
Question.
Yes.
You're using the Hoop conjecture as we know.
Yes.
But you have here a black hole that can be large for large masses and gets large for small masses. So why is it that they?
Okay. Actually, so in this case, I've taken a bit of a detour from that. So I'm not talking about the same metric here at this point. Okay, so this is just a standard formalism that can be applied to any metric. Okay. And I'm gonna come back to the one that I talked about before. Okay. Okay, so here's a full mathematical way of talking about it. All right, here's the probability that my particle is constrained in some, now this is a d-dimensional treatment of it, that it's confined to the space, that the horizon radius is that value. And that the particle is within its horizon. So once I can calculate, and if I am given a metric, I can calculate the horizon radius from it. I can go through and derive each of these things, assuming a standard distribution for the matter. It becomes a very easy calculation to do. And I end up, I can evaluate this and get a probability for that I'm going to have a black hole given those conditions. Okay. So that's the prescription for horizon wave function. There's a number of papers out there on this. And what is interesting to me that we looked at was what happens to the horizon wave function in arbitrary dimensions, this formalism. So if we revisit our d-dimensional metric again, this is a reminder a couple slides ago, it looks like this. So it's very easy to treat higher dimensional extra-dimensional type space-times, but of course, given a 1+1-dimensional space-time metric, we can also evaluate the prescription with that. So we did that, and in d-dimensional or d+1 dimensions, okay, once you go through the prescription, the probability that a black hole will be formed of that mass size in that length scale that you're talking about is this expression, and plot it out. Here it is for d equals 4 through 9, 4, 5, 8, 9, for different masses that actually verge into the sub-Planckian level. So each of these scales is the effective Planck scale for that dimension. Of course, that's not really the Planck scale. Right, they could be TeV scale or the like, depending on what the dimensions are. But you see a very interesting shift that happens as you go up in dimension. Okay. The probability, if you look at the probability for producing larger black holes, okay, here's the length scale on the horizontal, the probability for producing larger black holes actually decreases quite a bit, which actually has nothing to do with the generalized uncertainty principle here, or I guess it is sort of Planck scale black holes if you look at modified Planck scale, means that if you're doing accelerator searches for quantum black holes in higher dimensions, as we've been doing, assuming this prescription is realistic, we're not going to see them for increasingly high extra dimensions, numbers of extra dimensions. It drops off very quickly. Because okay, you can see the order of magnitude difference between these scales here on the vertical. So that's all well and good, but it gets away from this idea of sub-Planckian and dimensional reduction. So that's just what I said, the probability of sub-Planckian black hole formation decreases. But what happens if you treat this in a purely 1 plus 1 dimensional space-time? So again, this isn't the metric that I was talking about earlier, all right, but it's just the 1 plus 1 r equals t metric. And in fact, what you'll notice is that the behavior of these curves flips. Okay? So this is the smallest black hole here that has a mass half the Planck mass, whatever the one-dimensional Planck mass is. And then they get successively bigger, so that the probability of forming smaller black holes as you approach the Planck scale in a 1 plus 1-dimensional space-time is bigger than forming bigger black holes. And again, that sort of makes sense because the horizon size starts to get bigger. So again, we enter this world where sub-Planckian black holes not only can exist, but they're favorable if we consider this approach. Numerically, you can show that also these expressions, the probability expression, maxes out at around half. Okay. And a half is a very magical number in quantum mechanics because that's usually what we associate with a two-state system, where the two states in this case are being a black hole or not being a black hole. So in a sense, you could interpret that probability, the maximum probability, as being the fact that these black holes at the sub-Planckian scale are, quote-unquote, I'll call them naturally quantum objects. And there's no classical description here. The probability tells us that these things have a 50% chance of possibly being a black hole. And we can think of that as a quantum behavior. So that's a possible interpretation of this. And how does this tie into the GUP? Well, it turns out that this horizon wave function formalism is naturally linked to the GUP in that the GUP arises as a natural consequence of it. So basically, what is the GUP? It's delta P versus delta X, how the two vary. So if I know my horizon wave function and my spatial distribution, I can calculate all kinds of standard quantum statistical values. So for example, expectations of R, expectations of R squared, and so on and so forth. I also have momentum space versions of those. I can project the states into the momentum space and evaluate them accordingly. So I can come up with expressions for delta R. Okay, in this case, my spatial delta R is, we can think of it as a quantum delta R and the gravitational delta R, okay, just as we did at the beginning of the lecture. And then I can do a similar thing using the spatial extent or in the momentum space. And when I do that and go through and evaluate the functions, then I notice I get, this is for d equals 4, but it looks the same for d equals 3. So 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time looks the same for 4 plus 1, 5 plus 1, and so forth. I get that smooth curve that is reminiscent of the GUP that we want, with a continuous transition from super Planckian to sub-Planckian black holes. Okay. The shape of this shifts around and the values shift around as you go to increasing dimensions, but it is encapsulated, it is in there. If I evaluate it for the d plus 1, the 1 plus 1 dimensional space-time, I get this. Okay. No minimum anywhere. Okay. There's no critical value. There's no length scale or mass scale defined here. Okay. It is all one thing. It's all defined by one theory. So, and this course looks like a quantum scale. So we could say that this is evidence, quote unquote, if you want to call it evidence, or it suggests strongly suggestive that this theory is purely quantum, that a 1 plus 1 dimensional space-time naturally gives rise to quantum objects. And in the quest for quantum gravity, finding a gravity theory where everything is naturally quantum is what defines quantum gravity, I suppose. Right? Let me just end off by saying that, what happens if you combine both things? So what happens if you take that GUP metric that I talked about that gave us that duality and apply it to the horizon wave function formalism? You start to notice some very different behaviors. So here's the probability. So here's your horizon wave function. You go through the standard procedure. You evaluate the probability. Here is what it looks like for differing values of beta. So for beta equals 0, which is standard Schwarzschild in 3 plus 1 dimensions, so this is all 3 plus 1 dimensions now, you can see that the probability of becoming a black hole drops down to 0 quite rapidly for a sub-Planckian scale. But for beta greater than 0, so if I do allow this duality to come into play, so I allow this effective dimensional reduction, then I start to see minima occurring, okay, for the probability. And in fact, what happens here, we're unsure. Maybe we could analytically continue these up to 1, but we've provided a little mass cutoff because we're not exactly sure what the behavior is here. But it does show that if we allow for the GUP to come into play, then the presence of sub-Planckian black holes, the non-zero probability that they're there, becomes a feature. And this is a similar plot. This is the same thing except for length scale, which shows the same data. So I won't dwell on that. But it looks like I'm actually about the stage where I wanted to be, which is out of time. So let me conclude here that a number of lessons can come out of this. Okay? It's an exercise, if you will. We can think of it as a thought experiment. What happens, what are the implications of the GUP, okay, in terms of quantum gravity? So one of them is that if we allow the GUP to become a feature of the gravitational theory, and we allow it to become a feature of the geometry of the theory, then dimensional reduction is a natural consequence. Sub-Planckian black holes are a natural consequence. Okay. It gets rid of that classical thermodynamic instability of Schwarzschild. Of course, we don't believe that's going to happen at quantum scales anyway, but this gives us a way of possibly evaluating it. I talked about production of quantum scale black holes in higher dimensions. It becomes a bit harder. It's easier in lower dimensions. And again, this shows that the GUP seems to be undivorceable from gravity. So it's something that we should be looking for as a feature in the future. And lastly, I think the real profound idea here is that nature is not described by two different theories, okay, but being quantum mechanics and relativity, but it's in fact defined by a single theory, geometry, that is existing in two different space-time dimensions. So the quantum scale is lower dimensional. The classical scale is higher dimensional. So anyway, so those are my thoughts. Thank you for listening. And before I conclude, let me do a shameless plug for this is a conference that I help to run. We're on our third edition this summer. It's called the Karl Schwarzschild Meeting in Frankfurt. We hold it at the end of July. Here is our keynote speakers that we're going to. Our registration will be opening soon. If you want to jot this down or email me, I can send you details. It's a very fun conference. I'm not biased, but if you wish to learn more about it, I would encourage you to either visit the website or give me a shout and I can fill you in on that. So anyway, thank you very much for your attention. Any questions? Yes, sir.
How do these results affect the information health paradigm?
It's interesting. So we put a bit of thought into that. I mean, basically the information loss paradox, well, that's more predicated on whether or not we have an event horizon that exists, right? So it's a good question. I don't how that applies. I mean, the event horizon in the GUP, for example, the GUP inspired is not disappearing, all right? You still have the event horizon there, right? So it's possible to come up with a regular type black hole where you can sort of circumvent the horizon, but that's a bit of we've been playing with that, but it doesn't really not really working right now. So how does it affect that? We don't have enough information right now to really talk about that, but it's certainly an avenue that bears looking at. And in fact, does the GUP say anything about information loss in general? Right. Is an interesting question.
As you mentioned, everything hinges on the starting point is the GUP.
Yes.
And then there's a whole bunch of relations that you derive, which may or may not be right, may or may not be, or could be just wishful thinking.
Right.
Okay, something's compelling you to go in that direction. What a prediction to say, okay, if these fall through, then everything was just a mirage. But if it is correct, then we should pay much more attention to it.
Right. Well, so I suppose the predictions hinge on, you know, approaching the Planck. We need Planck scale type measurements, right? And that is a problem that plagues any theory of quantum gravity, right? What the predictions are of this thing, for example, are in the large scale, it should reduce to general relativity, which it does, right? And we know that's mostly a correct theory for length scales from here to galaxy clusters, for example. One could, in principle, derive observational consequences of this. My colleagues who I worked on the horizon wave function paper with threw some numbers into BlackMax and calculated some cross sections for production for particles in this framework. So there is some experimental evidence for that part of it. And like I said, I mean for higher dimensional space times, it predicts there is a suppression of larger black hole production. So if you do have black hole production and you can show that that doesn't match the standard ADD scenarios and the like, then
we found no evidence
at all, right? So that's, yeah. And that, at the end of the day, that's what constrains your theory, right? So if we can make some predictions, I mean, again, they would have to be very high energy predictions at this point. But, you never know. So the two most compelling pieces of data that we have or will have shortly for black holes are the LIGO result, or results, and the Event Horizon Telescope, right? And the going ideas is that the Event Horizon is itself a quantum feature of a black hole. So with the Event Horizon Telescope, you're going to see macroscopic enhancement of potential quantum effects. So would something like this be visible under this framework in the EHT? Could you see it in some kind of ring down phase, right, of a black hole from a merger? Hard to say. It's probably not likely because of the mass scales involved, but that's the point, right? If you come up with a quantum gravity theory, you want to be able to test it. You want to find predictions that can be made. So otherwise, it's just, indistinguishable from the current macroscopics version. Yes?
So can you go back to your slide where you wrote down this metric for a black hole in the center of data?
The GUP one? Yeah. All right, almost there. Well, there's this. Oh, that's not okay. That's dimensional reduction. It probably would have been easier to I just split the, all right, there we go. Here it is.
So if I go far away from this object mm-hmm. and ask what the gravitational mass is, mm-hmm. it's not going to be this parameter you're calling M, right?
Right, it'll be an approximation, it will, but
well,
far.
Would it just be M times that stuff in parentheses? So if I just rewrite this metric in terms of the actual
right. and then
mass that you, put, you feel will be using the Schwarzschild metric?
You'll get the Schwarzschild measure, but so yes, you're right. For large r, right, that this extra term doesn't go away. It depends on the size of m versus that. So in principle, this is, that's another word. In fact, this is something I've thought of is, you know.
But I mean, so what does this parameter m in the metric mean if it's not the gravitational mass?
It is the result of some. It is similar to an ADM mass, right? So is it? The full implications we haven't really thought of it, but
well, it is a gravitational mass.
Yeah.
If you look for a test particle, it would
be
plus one beta.
It's
right.
I
asked that before.
Yeah.
If you define the mass view and how it affects the metrics, that whole thing is the mass.
Right. Okay. So yeah, this is
just
we're
still metric that you're calling.
Yeah. You basically is redefining the mass. I mean, but what's interesting is. Right, for large masses, we're not going to notice any difference because they're going to be much larger than the Planck's mass. You know, I've envisioned an idea for maybe a tabletop experiment where you actually have, you know, using optical tweezers or the like, can you actually get masses that are 10 to the 8th grams, right? Less than that. Can one set up some kind of torsion experiment, even just simple? You know, simple gravitational experiment using these optical tweezers to measure the gravitational attraction of these two sub-Planckian particles. Right? I mean, that's another way to possibly test this. I have no idea how one would do it. You'd have to get into a microgravity regime, but yeah. So, any other questions? All right. Well, thank you again for coming.
Thanks for listening.